Welcome to the Fremantle Press Podcast. My name is Rebecca Hickey, and today I'm joined by Shirley Ma to talk about her new middle grade novel, Little Jung. This book features hopping vampires, shape-shifting foxes, and glutinous rice ball launchers. So settle in as we talk about the silly and the serious in the world of Own Voices books for kids. Shirley Ma is a first-generation Chinese-Australian and author of young adult and children's fiction. It was while she was writing a very dry PhD on accounting that she realised she'd rather be writing down her dark, twisted daydreams instead. She is still an accountant by day and a masked writer at night. She's the only person she knows who has ever been kicked out of a bookstore for disruptive behaviour. Welcome, Shirley.
Thank you, Beck. Thank you so much for having me today.
Now, before we get started, I have to know, how did you get kicked out of a bookstore for disruptive behaviour?
I like, firstly, how my reputation precedes me. But since you asked so nicely, I'm going to tell you the story. Okay, this was 10 years ago when there was a particular chain of bookstore in the city. It was double story. It had a basement.
Okay, and I can picture it.
Yes, and in the basement they had the YA section right next to the little kids section, you know, with the rugs. And the beanbags and the little chairs. It was a huge basement, but for some reason, those two were like literally the bookcases were back to back. And also about that time, we'd heard about this fantastic new book that featured not hopping vampires, but sparkling vampires.
Interesting.
So me and a friend of mine thought, we just go down to the basement. Let's find this book and see what the fuss is about. So we located the book. And before we knew it, we were so engrossed in it, we started literally reading passages out to each other. But unfortunately, there was a huge group of kids like on the carpet reading picture books.
Oh, no.
At the same time, we were like reading these passages to each other, and they're not by any account child-friendly.
No.
Okay, the next thing I knew, the manager of the bookstore had approached us and said, we've had some complaints from the parents about you two. Can you please both just leave? So we got kicked out of this bookstore. But I just do want to say for the listeners out there, please do not do this at your local bookstore and please support your local bookstore.
Absolutely.
Don't get kicked out.
Don't get kicked out of bookstore.
Yeah.
Or at least buy something first before you get kicked out, right?
Buy something first.
Yeah. Have the decency to buy something first.
Correct.
Awesome. Now, let's get to your new book. So tell us about Little Jung.
Okay. So Little Jung is, I'd say it was like a caper adventure book for kids in primary school. And it follows the adventures of this little vampire, little Chinese vampire called Little Jung, and this sort of weird town that he gets involved in, one of the weird townsfolk. And it's also about a little girl called Mei who tries to help him as well. And they have this little adventure together. And it's sort of like quirky and hopefully funny as well.
It's definitely quirky and funny. And
Thank you.
I think caper is a really good description.
Yeah, I like the word caper.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, it signals that there's a bit of kind of mischief behind the adventure.
I'm pleased about that, Beck, because you know about mischief.
Yes,
I know
indeed.
That.
Now, as I was reading, I kept wondering what elements were from Chinese mythology and what elements were invented by you. Like, I was really intrigued by the blending of these two things. So can you tell us what informed your ideas and how you adapted or combined them for the story?
Okay, the elements from Chinese mythology that are real are obviously the Jiangshi, the hopping vampires, also the fox spirit, and I've also got like horse face and ox head in there, and what I call ghost land, which is basically the Chinese underworld. So those are all traditional mythological elements I just pulled, and I just thought, mix it up a bit and bring it into the current century and just make it really modern and fun. So a bit of like a reboot of the old stories, yeah.
Yeah, I really I really loved like how you threw everything together. I was so curious about where all this stuff comes from, but also how it kind of operated in the modern world.
Like, oh, thank you. Yeah. Because my intention with this book was to write something to entertain the kids, but also something really weird, like a little weird Netflix sort of X-Files sort of show that you might stumble on and watch and be really entertained by. That's for the kids as well, but for the parents, they can sort of, you know, get into it too if they are the sort of parent that wants to read the books their children take home first, just to make sure it's suitable. So I was aware of, like, you know, having a little bit of entertainment value for them as well.
Yeah, there's definitely entertainment value. I loved it. From I was saying this just before we started recording, that from page one, it's just like go, 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 action, action, action. It's really good.
Yeah, I just wanted to keep it going.
Yeah, absolutely.
Keep it fun.
Now, this is an own voices book with an own voices illustrator. So for our audience members not familiar with own voices stories, can you tell me what they are and why they're important, especially for kids?
Okay, so own voices is basically groups of marginalized authors or authors from minority groups just having an opportunity to tell their stories. So I would say that I'm a Asian voices or Chinese voices author, but I also want to stress that own voices is not just about race or creed. It goes further beyond that. So if you're like a double lung transplant and you write your story, that's own voices. If you're like part of the LGBTQ group and you write your own story, that's own voices too. And like I'd go as far to say that if you suffered bullying in high school and you're brave enough to share that story, that is own voices to me. And it's important for kids because they see this representation that might have not traditionally been there in the past. And I just think it's important for them to learn these stories and be empowered by them as well if they feel that that's also their voice.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the way that I often understand it is that it's actually coming from the person who had that experience.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel as well. And it can be quite wide-reaching. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious how the publishing industry is responding to Own Voices stories.
I think there has been, like, a huge call-out for Own Voices. I follow a it's like mswishlist.com, which is basically like a compilation of what agents and editors are calling for.
Oh,
like,
cool.
Just
how
a compilation. Yeah, just a compilation of like daily tweets and things. And there is such a big call out for own voices, which is so heartening to see. And across like all different, you know, the whole range, the whole gamut of own voices as well. So I'm like, wow, this is really an opportunity for people to look at this and go, like, I've got that story and I want to write it and I want to put it out there. So I think it's amazing.
What do you think's driving that? Do you think it's readers?
I think it's readers and also like a change in sort of like the publishing atmosphere as well in terms of what books people want. Because I think in this society where there's a lot of like instant everything and also a lot of fakery, people feel they want like real stories, like true stories. They may be wrapped up in fiction, but at the core of it, there's something really genuine about it. And I think that's what readers perhaps are looking for at the moment.
Yeah, and authenticity, I imagine.
Authenticity, exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I recently had a funny interchange on Instagram with the writer Holden Shepherd, where he Holden posted saying something about how he didn't like particular tropes that straight people use about gay people.
Yes.
And it was interesting when I said that this was really fascinating and I'm really happy I didn't do these tropes as a straight woman when writing about having some gay characters. And it was like, oh, I didn't mean to say, like, I hope I wasn't too strident and you know, I don't want to say that straight people can't write these things. And I thought that was really interesting how he kind of instantly almost felt like he had to explain. Do you think that often own voices writers feel like they have to go, oh, I'm not stepping on anyone's toes. Like, I just want to tell my story. Like, is there some politics in that? I'm really curious.
Firstly, I want to applaud Holden for what he tweeted. And I just want to say I feel the same way, that as an own voices writer, I do really encourage other authors, even though they may not be Chinese, to write about Chinese and Asian characters. And that as long as I do it from a place of authenticity and research, I really encourage it because that's representation. And I believe diversity in all forms is important in books.
But I think it is important that we really interrogate how we do things, especially if we come from a place of privilege. And one thing I felt with what Holden was saying, I felt like he... and I've noticed this with a lot of other writers that they often feel like they need to say, oh, no, I'm not trying to tread on anyone's toes. But that's, I don't think, what do you think? Do you often feel their own voice as writers kind of are kind of made to feel like they need to explain themselves or?
In a way, yes. But in a way also no, because the way I feel, I'm just going to tell my own story in the way I want to tell it.
Yeah.
And if people want to tell stories that aren't, you know, authentic to them, they have a right to do that because as storytellers, we're basically just, you know, making stuff up.
Yeah.
Making stuff up. But I just think that if they go in with the right intentions, they do their research, they understand, then I think it's great. People can write about what they want to write about.
Yeah. But, yeah, I do really appreciate that there are own voices, stories actually coming from a really authentic place. And
me too.
You know, I think it's wonderful that the industry is actually, and the website you mentioned is actually, there are so many opportunities coming out, which is wonderful.
Opportunities for people that just think, oh, maybe I'm not important, my voice doesn't matter. But these voices do because we need a whole diverse range of voices. And it's great for the reader as well because they've got so much choice on what stories they can read and so much to learn as well because it's also educational.
Yeah.
But in a fun way.
Yeah.
So it's good. I love it.
Yeah, and I one thing I was actually thinking about with your book is you never explain where things come from. So you never say, like, Xingxi are vampires from Chinese mythology. You just kind of write the story as... And so kids can kind of get into this story without any kind of, you don't explain things, which I really love. I think that's really important. Was it conscious that you did this? Like you didn't explain where everything's from?
I decided to take a very soft world-building approach to this book. So things are like mysterious. You might not necessarily get all the information you need, but you put it together and that makes it sort of exciting. And at the end of the day, I didn't want to write a textbook. I wanted to write something entertaining and fun.
Yeah.
So that's how I rolled.
And it worked brilliantly.
Oh, thank you.
It also made me think that there must be a lot of kids like May that feel like they need to explain themselves a lot to other people if they've got particular, like if they come from a particular heritage. And I like that you didn't, it's like, no, you don't have to explain yourself. You can just be what you are.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think, it was like one of the messages I wanted to put across in the book that despite if you're a human in the book or whether you're a fantasy creature, you don't have to explain yourself. You can just be how you want. Exactly. And I think especially with the fox spirit, traditionally she's portrayed as a woman who goes around seducing men. She's a bad guy, really. But when you think about it, she's just doing what she wants, which is hearts.
I really liked her. She was just like really strong character.
Yeah, she just knows what she's after, men's hearts, and what she wants to do in life, and she just goes about it. And I don't think she needs to apologize for that, and I don't think she needs to be cast in a bad light because of that.
No.
So I've just brought her into the common world, into the modern world, where she just does what she wants and she doesn't need to explain herself. She's just strong and a woman.
And I imagine a lot of kids will see that character and go, yeah, like, you know, I love this kind of strong, powerful character. This is something that I can embody and, you know, I can be the fox spirit. Yeah.
It's just a funny thing because in Chinese mythology, when a common fox reaches like a certain age, they have the ability to become a woman. And when they become another certain great age, they have the ability to become a beautiful woman. So, and I just thought, how can I mess with this?
Yeah.
So this is what I ended up doing in the book, because I just thought, that is just so sexist.
Yeah.
But she is who she is. That's how she came about. So let's make her really, like, modern and kick-ass. So I did.
That's actually something that I thought as I was reading it. There's so many things for boys and girls in this book, you know, like, and I don't like that dichotomy, you know, this has to be a book for boys or this has to be a book for girls. I think that books can be for whoever likes to read them.
Exactly. I think the best book is a book the whole family
absolutely.
Read. Like, it may be a kid's book, but if the parents have to read it, I don't think, hopefully they won't complain too much about it, because it's, I've tried to aim it at broadly everyone so that everyone can have a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, talking about having a good time, there are a lot of very silly, fun moments in this book.
Mm-hmm.
I really think that I'd be really useless at writing humour, but I found myself laughing out loud when I read this book. So can you give us some tips for writing humour?
Okay. First off the bat, I have to explain that I am not a funny person by any means. I'm probably more of a really depressing person. Because I have this book coming out next year called A Glasshouse of Stars, and I remember the first time my editor read the manuscript, she said that she had to leave her laptop four times to go and cry. So
wow.
I'm more that sort of person. But with humour, I have a few tricks. Would you like to know about those tricks, Beck? Okay.
Please.
This is a technique called let the weirdness in. So you just think, just have a think. We've got Chinese hopping vampires. Traditionally, they're like scared of glutinous rice because it burns them.
Mm.
And you just think to yourself, how could I actually make this funny for kids? So how about we have the rice, but we launch them out of these like super soaker things, like these brightly coloured launches, and it hits them in the chest and burns a hole in them, and then they scream and fall over. So and I thought, there you go.
Yeah.
you can make something funny if you just think of it, you know, in terms
let
of like
the weird in.
Let the weird in.
Yeah.
And also with the fox spirit, like, does anybody really know what noise a fox makes? I know it's a song on YouTube, but really. So I was thinking to myself, they probably do make a really awful noise. So why not make her a busker with a really bad voice, singing really bad songs to people that are just like shielding themselves away from her and just trying to avoid her. So that is my technique. Let the weirdness in.
I think that's a really good tip.
Thank you.
So if you don't have a sense of humour, just let the weird in.
Just let the weird in. And weird, I think, would translate to funny.
Absolutely. Now, behind all this silliness, there are some big themes in your book, some of them we've already covered. You also look at how bullies are often bullied themselves, how the absence of love can make us heartless, and how little people can have big impacts. So what do you think are the best ways to sneak big ideas into kids' lit?
Firstly, thank you for recognising all these things, because putting stuff like this into my books is what makes writing worthwhile.
Mm.
And, like, I want to write something fun and entertaining, but at the same time I want to give it a little bit of depth as well, because I think important themes like these deserve to be in kids' books. And I just feel like I owe it to them to put it in there, because it's important for kids to read about. And I think the best way for me to do it is really to embody my characters with these, you know, feelings and characteristics and make it part of them so that it doesn't come off as like, I don't want to write an issues book pointing out issues, and I don't want to be like a parent, you know, pointing things out. I just want it to be natural and really ingrained into the story.
Mm.
So, and that's what I do.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things I love about kids' books, that it's maybe I'm being unkind when I say sneaking it in. It's just kind of organically part of the story.
Yeah.
Like, kids' existence can be, you know, fun and silly, and whatever. But at the same time, kids have to grapple with such big things.
Yes.
And they have so little agency, yes. I find.
And I think it's really important to have it in books because often, you know, when I was young, I used to seek solace in books.
Mm,
so
me too.
To see it there and to not, as an author, not shy away from it and put it in there is, I think it's almost like a civic duty.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Now, your book is illustrated by Katie Jung. So can you take us through the process of working with an illustrator?
It was so fun. Like, this is the first time I've worked with an illustrator and I am just so rapt that not only did Fremantle Press accept my own voices novel, they also found me like an own voices illustrator because Katie draws in the traditional Chinese style by hand. And to work with her was just a really thrilling experience. And I just wanted her to do her own thing. I didn't want to dictate to her how my characters, you know, looked in a certain way. I just wanted to see what would blossom out of this relationship we both had. And the illustrations she's come up with, I believe there's 12 in the book, I just think are absolutely stunning and like how I imagined my world.
Mm.
And I just think the story and the illustrations, they complement each other so well. And
I'm
just so proud of the whole process. Like I just remember Kate Sutherland sending me through like all the drafts and I was just being absolutely thrilled by what I was seeing. And she would ask me, well, do you have any feedback on these? And I'm like, what if I just say they're perfect? And like, I have none. Does that sound like a cop out?
I'm quite fascinated by that because I think if I was in the same circumstances, I would be like, oh, I'm really nervous. What are they going to do? Like, did you have any of that anxiety?
I was nervous as well. Yeah. Like, I was nervous before the whole process started and I knew there was going to be illustrations. I was like, oh, my goodness, who are they going to get? What's it going to end up looking like? But I'm so thankful that they brought Katie on board. I think it was meant to be. And even Kate Sutherland said herself that it was a bit of kismet because the novel's called Little Jiang.
Yeah.
And this is Katie Jiang, but I just want the listeners to know that it's a different sort of Jiang. Katie's surname is a very noble old surname. I believe it means river and not cheese-sucking, hopping Chinese vampire.
She's not, okay. She's, note to self. She's,
no.
She's not
no,
a vampire.
No, she's not a vampire. Not that I know of.
Have you seen her hopping? That's the question.
Gosh. She walks pretty well, but, you know, you never know. No, sorry, Katie. Katie's a wonderful real-life woman, very inspirational and just an awesome person. So,
I do agree that the pictures really do complement the story very well. They seem to – there's a similar energy in them, I feel.
Yes, yes, yeah. Energy. I like that.
Now, I also want to talk to you about community. So in your acknowledgements, you thank other members of what you call the Faux Four, and that's Christy Byrne, H.M. Waugh, and Nadia L. King. So can you tell me about the Faux Four?
Okay. They are my little posse. And I believe all authors need to have sort of like a little posse because writing is a really lonely experience.
Mm.
I know because for my first 10 years of writing, I did it all alone and it was terrible. But then I found this group of friends and things just became so much better because we get together in cafes, we just with our laptops and we just chat, talk about the publishing industry in glowing terms, of course, and we just write and we look at each other's work and we support each other. And I just think that's really important, you know, to have your tribe.
Yeah.
And they're my tribe. And this is an interesting fact. Christy and HM, who are also Fremantle authors, we all live on the same street together, all three of us.
How did that happen? Did you just discovered that one day? How interesting.
I guess kismet, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we're always trying to convince Nadia to
move
onto
to
the street.
So
we can be like one big community and we can just walk to the cafe every day and see each other.
Yeah. And I have to ask behind the name, Faux Four?
Okay, Faux Four because we kind of feel like... I know this is terrible, but writers sort of like have a bit of an imposter syndrome sometimes. Mm. So instead of being like a fab four or a real four, we call ourselves a faux four, but not a fake four, just a faux four.
Yeah. No, I like that. I have a writing posse as well, and we call ourselves the Tugboats.
The Tugboats.
Yeah, because we pull each other along.
That's beautiful. Love it, Beck.
I wonder, I'd love to know more about the faux four. How do you guys work together and how do you support each other's writing?
We try and see each other regularly. Mm. We've been doing cafes for a long time, but in these COVID times, we've found that waistlines are stretching a little bit. Yep. So now we've taken to doing walk, talk and plots.
Nice.
Just along the river.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So we see each other, we talk about writing and other things, and I guess we help to inspire each other as well because we're always doing so many things at the same time, and then like one person's got a new book deal, someone's signed a contract. So I find that really buoys us and it just, it's important because writing by yourself and having no friends is really sad and really lonely. And at first I thought, you know what, that's really romantic. I'm just going to shut myself in my room, do my own thing, write my masterpiece, but that's a horrible, horrible experience and a way to be. So I encourage all those writers out there, find critique groups, go to events, meet other authors, make friends.
Yeah, I agree completely because until I had the Tugboats, I didn't write more than a few chapters. The reason my book took 12 years to write was because I was only accountable to me and I couldn't trust myself. So I needed someone else to be accountable for. So I would set up deadlines online with these friends and they would all know, okay, chapter 3 or chapter 4 or chapter 5 is due. Where is it?
Oh, amazing. That's great. You need people like that to push you along, like in the best way.
Absolutely, yeah. Supportive and encouraging, but also like, hey, are you still writing? Are you still going okay?
That's right. Yeah. And I think authors sort of need other authors to understand them because we just have the strangest gripes sometimes and the strangest issues. So it makes sense and it works.
Yeah, absolutely. Hmm. Now, but before we finish today, I would love to have a passage from Little Zheng. So what will you be reading for us today?
Awesome. I always believe in starting from the beginning. So
let's
go from chapter one.
Okay. So when you are ready, take it away.
Mei Ling Pang was born at an inauspicious time on an inauspicious day, in an inauspicious month, so bad luck liked to follow her around. Strange things did too, like the ghastly-looking figures with their white faces and waist-long tongues hanging out in front of her parents' restaurant, staring at the display of roast ducks and licking the glass. In the corner of her eyes, Mei could always see shadows and movement, but it got particularly bad when the gate to Ghostland opened. Mei hated Hungry Ghost Month. It's the one time of the year when all those in the spirit world are let out to do as they wish. They may want to visit relatives or just have a bit of fun, Ma explained each August, as they knelt together and stuck joss sticks into the brass pot and arranged the offerings of oranges and red tortoise cakes by the front door. If they have one thing in common, it's that they are all ravenous. If we can make sure that they are well fed, then hopefully it brings us good luck. And boy, did they need some good luck right now. Mei looked sadly around the Augusta moon. The restaurant used to shine in red and gold glory, but the gold had tarnished and the red had faded to a dull pinkish orange. She squeezed her eyes shut and wished fervently for a truckload of customers. Opening one eye and then the other, Mei was not met with customers, but with ghosts of all shapes and sizes ogling the food and tasting the curling smoke from the incense. She groaned and rubbed her eyes. Nope, they were still there and they were very real. Mei didn't know why she was able to see things that other people couldn't. All she knew for sure was that she always had. Her earliest memory was being pushed on a swing by a little girl with long blue-black hair, a red cherry blossom dress, and holes in her face where her eye should be. She had told second auntie, "Look, she's still pushing the string." Second auntie had stared long and hard at the swing swaying back and forth by itself, despite the lack of breeze, and clutched tightly at her jade beads. When they got home, second auntie confronted Ma Pang with the fact that May might be cursed. "Don't tell anyone about this, please," Ma had begged her sister. "May's just a special girl. Don't do anything to make her life hard for her or make her think she's different." But second auntie was the sort of person who, if she knew one secret, would go around telling two. Ma knew something had to change. The quiet, unassuming suburb of Honeywood, Australia, was a place where everyone knew each other by name, the golf course was always green, and nothing out of the ordinary ever happened. Everything was normal. Strange Chinese monsters didn't exist. In fact, nobody even believed in monsters. Which is precisely why Ma and Ba Pang had moved from Hong Kong to Honeywood, hoping for a fresh start and to get away from the various ghost-busting grandmasters that second auntie kept trying to suggest as a cure. Which was great, until Ma realised that all the strange things they had tried to leave behind had simply followed them. Before long, everyone in Honeywood knew that something was wrong with May. She was the girl who shouted at thin air, flapped her arms madly at nothing, and acted like a weirdo. The one who made shivers run down their spines. Although May knew it was actually little demons tickling their backbone. Nobody wanted to be her friend.
Wonderful, Shirley. Thank you so much. Listeners, you can find Little Zheng in all good bookstores and online at fremantlepress.com.au. Shirley, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Beck. It's been great fun.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. If you enjoyed our chat today, subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. My name's Rebecca Higgy, and I've been your host today. In 2019, I won the Fogarty Literary Award, and my own novel, The History of Mischief, is out now. Join me next time as we explore everything silly and serious about the world of books.